One of the greatest needs in any group is leadership. Whether it's an athletic team, whether it's some kind of an educational or a school team, maybe the math team or whatever, you need some kind of leadership to help it to be what it can be, to help it be all it can be. Well, nowhere is this more important than in the church. And I know many of you are probably saying, well, that's right, David. We need good elders and deacons, and we need people to preach the gospel, and we need the wives of those people and mature members and their wives and husbands. We need them so desperately, and we do. But we need to recognize that leadership can come from various places and in various ways can help God's people. It doesn't just have to come through elders and deacons and preachers and mature members. And so I want to talk about that with you this morning. And I don't know of a better book that talks about leadership and the qualities of leadership in a more concise way than the book of Nehemiah. Now, you might say, well, Jesus shows the qualities of leadership better than this, and I know that's so. But I'm talking about a book that is other than maybe the Gospels, other than that which we read about Jesus Christ. We see the leadership of Nehemiah in a very wonderful way, in a very moving way. And there's something about it that reaches down into us, or ought to reach down into us, and make us realize what we can be and what we can do for the Lord. The story that we just began reading a while ago from Nehemiah chapter 1 takes place somewhere around 440 B.C., Now, many of you know that the Babylonians took away kind of the final carrying away of the Israelites, or Judah rather, in 586 B.C., and it was prophesied that they would be brought back. Now, they were. In 536 B.C., they came back and began building the temple of the Lord, laid the foundation, but then they got distracted and started building their houses and taking care of their own businesses. Until Zechariah and Haggai rose up, and Haggai especially said, you're living in sealed houses. Personally, you have nice houses, and the house of the Lord goes wanting. Now, let's rise up and build it. And they did, and finished it in about 516 B.C. Now, about 90 years have passed, or thereabouts. And the walls of Jerusalem are still crumbled, and the gates are burned, and the people are in distress. And Hananiah, one of Nehemiah's brethren, comes, and he tells Nehemiah, he asks, well, how are things in Jerusalem? He says, well, the walls are broken down. There's rubble everywhere. The gates are burned. The people are in distress because of their enemies. And Nehemiah sat down and he cried. I want to tell you that Nehemiah is one of those few characters in the Bible that you don't read anything negative about. Now, we know he's a human and we know he sinned because we know no one was perfect but our Lord. But it is interesting that of all the people that a lot of good is said about, and Joshua comes to mind right now, Joshua was still fooled by the Gibeonites, didn't go to the Lord in prayer and ask the Lord about that. Nehemiah seems to be such a good man who was determined to help rebuild those walls and rebuild the Lord's purposes. And he instilled in those people, well, he instilled in them a deeper faith and, in a sense, a deeper faith in themselves. And I think, in a very real sense, those two things need to go together. And so what I want to do is I want to look at some of the qualities that we see in Nehemiah in the leadership in rebuilding these walls. Now, obviously, I'm just going to have to deal with that in a very hastened way. But I want to look at four things that I think are very, very important. First of all, when we look at the marks of leadership in Nehemiah, we need to begin by realizing that all leadership, the best leadership, begins with a genuine, now this is a genuine, fervent love and concern for God's cause. And we see that in Nehemiah. As I've already mentioned, he sat down when he heard about the distress of the people and he cried. The Bible says he cried and mourned for many days. When is the last time you've cried about something? Well, you may say, well, I cried when I found out that my children were sick or some relatives were very ill, maybe at the point of death. I wept when I found out that some members weren't what they should be or when they had fallen away from the Lord. Maybe I didn't make the grades I was expecting to make, or maybe I'm making the grades I expected to make. And you might cry over something like that. I remember One Thanksgiving, I think there was one Thanksgiving in my life, and believe me, this is probably the truth, that I actually lost weight. And it was right in the midst of a problem, a church problem. And people were misbehaving and acting in an ugly way and doing things that just were not Christian and acting very deviously. But I want you to notice that in this particular case, Nehemiah didn't cry because the people were immoral. He didn't cry because they were doing things that were just absolutely against what God had told them to do necessarily. He was crying because Jerusalem was broken down and because the people weren't what they could be and should be. And it's so easy for us just to kind of stroll along, you know. Just to kind of stroll along as Christians and to take solace in the fact that we're not hotheads or we're not immoral or we're not liars or we're not this and we're not that, when we may not really see that there are cracks in our walls. Maybe in the walls of our lives, personally. Like Peter, who said to the Lord, "Though all men forsake you, I'll never forsake you." And Jesus said, "Oh yes, you will. Before the rooster crows twice, you'll deny me three times, Peter." Peter had cracks in his wall. He didn't see that. Sometimes in churches, we have cracks in our walls. Maybe some of the walls are broken down and the gates have been charred. We may need to rebuild, refurbish some things. We need to see that. And we have to have a concern for that. We have to think about that. Something that goes along with this so much when you think about deep love and concern for God's purposes is prayer. And that's interesting to me as I see Nehemiah pray here. And you notice in our reading in chapter 1 how Nehemiah didn't just pray for himself, he prayed for the people. He asked God to forgive the people because we have indeed been sinful. And he recognized that. You know, you go to the first century, and you see that Christians didn't take that for granted. Christians understood that they had access to the most, well, to the power of the universe. Now, sometimes people say, "Oh, well, you know, that's kind of corny." Well, those are the people that aren't going to make much difference in His presence of in prayer, too. But you think about early Christians and how much time they spent in prayer. Turn with me to Acts 4 for just a minute. I want to show you a particular time where Christians prayed. And of course, this is when Peter and John, we referred to this morning, actually, the event where Peter and John were threatened, "Don't you speak in the name of Jesus anymore," you know. And they went back to their company, to the church, and they just had this wonderful prayer. This is a wonderful, wonderful prayer. Now, I'm not going to read all of it. It begins in verse 23, but I want to begin with verse 29. I'm in Acts chapter 4 and verse 29. Here are the Christians praying together. "Now, Lord, look on their threats and grant to your servants that with all boldness they may speak your word. By stretching out your hand to heal, that the signs and wonders may be done through the name of your holy servant Jesus." And when they had prayed, the place where they were assembled together was shaken and they were all filled with the Holy Spirit and they spoke the word of God with boldness. Christians here recognized that they were in a lot of trouble. That is, there were a lot of adversaries around them, and yet they didn't pray that they would not be hurt or that nothing would happen necessarily. What they were praying was, "Let us be bold. Let us speak." And you go right through Acts. Saul of Tarsus in Acts chapter 9, after the Lord appeared to him, prayed. It looked like he prayed. Not only did he not eat and drink for 3 days, he prayed, it looked like, for 3 days. Acts chapter 10, Cornelius got God's attention by praying constantly. Acts chapter 12, when Peter was in prison, the church was meeting in Mary's home, John Mark's mother. And what were they doing? Praying. Acts chapter 13, before Barnabas and Saul or Paul were separated for the first missionary journey, what did they do before they laid their hands? They prayed. And you could just go right through the book of Acts that way. I want to tell you, too often we use it as an afterthought. Some of you know I'm trying to build a house and, you know, cleared off the lot, and I've been talking with some subs, and yesterday I tried to call some people to get their advice, and I tried to call this person and they were not home. I tried to call this person and they weren't at home, and I tried to talk to this person, well, they weren't there, and I did get one. And as I pressed that end on that phone, I realized, you know, on this particular matter, I haven't even talked to God. Well, David, that's silly. The Lord's not going to whisper something in your ear and say, use this sub and use that sub. No, I don't think necessarily that's going to happen. But I want to tell you this. In everything we do, and I'm not just meaning some kind of carnal thing, but in everything we do, one of the first things we ought to do is think about praying to God. And that's one of the most important things in leadership. Show me the best leader, and I'll show you somebody that's praying. Jesus prayed. Tell you something prayer will help you do. Prayer will help remind you of some basic things. First of all, you don't know what the future holds, and you don't change the future. Oh, you can do what you can do. I know. And in that, you can change the future to some degree, but there are so many variables there, so many things going on. How can you know? How can you change it? But a second thing you learn is that God does know, and God can change the future. And so as we think about leaders or leadership, we shouldn't say something like, you know, somebody else. Because I tell you what we can do, and you don't have to be an elder or a deacon to do this. We can pray. And if we have love and concern for the Lord's cause and work genuinely, and we lift up our prayer to Him, we can become very passionately involved in the Lord's work, and that is at the very beginning of leadership. It's there. And a person who tries to lead anybody without believing in what they're doing and eliciting God's help, they're not going to be that successful. Nehemiah was not that kind of person. A second thing. Leadership involves good planning. Now, I want you to go with me to chapter 2 now for just a moment. A book of Nehemiah, of course. And I want you to begin reading with me with about verse 11. Now, Nehemiah is granted permission by the king, Artaxerxes Longimanus, to go back to Jerusalem, rebuild the walls, and to get it in better shape. But we see here that Nehemiah, one of the first things he does when he gets back to Jerusalem, is he goes out on his own, riding on his beast. Look at verse 11. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Then I rose in the night, I and a few men with me. I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem. Nor was there any animal with me except the one on which I rode. And I went out by night through the valley gate to the serpent well and the refuse gate, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem which were broken down and its gates which were burned with fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, and there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. So I went up in the night by the valley and viewed the wall. Then I turned back and entered by the valley gate and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done. I had not told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the others who did the work. The first thing we've got to do is we've got to plan. And before we do that, we've got to see things for the way they really are. And Nehemiah got on his beast, and he went out riding around, and he saw the rubble here and the gates knocked down there, and he couldn't get through over here because there's so much rubble. But he looked around, and he saw the way things were. You know, one of the dangers sometimes in churches is we don't like to see ourselves for what we really are, individually or as a church. And this isn't, again, necessarily just a reprimand of Auburn, but I will tell you it is a warning. I think about the church at Corinth in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Do you remember? They had a man that was a member of the church in Corinth in 1 Corinthians 5 who had his father's wife. And Paul wrote to him and said, I'm not even there, and I can tell you exactly what you must do. Even the Gentiles don't know that kind of activity. They don't practice that. And basically he said that you need to mark that person. You need to let that person know where they are, that they may be saved in the day of visitation. Some churches want to feel good about themselves. You know, we live in a time where we are feel good about ourselves. Well, that's good. I do think that the Lord wants us to have a healthy self-esteem. Love your neighbor as yourself. But He doesn't want us to deny and to ignore and to pretend that we don't have maybe some cracks or some rubble or some charred gates. He wants us to see those things and to realize that those are important things. I've known of churches. I've gone to churches that have really stopped standing for certain principles in the Bible. and aren't really reaching out to the lost anymore, and aren't practicing discipline. But they have a name. But do they have a name with God? That's the important thing. And before we can go forward, we have to know what the situation is. And let me say this, because I think this is one of the biggest problems we have in too many churches. And again, I want to be careful to set myself up as somebody who knows all the problems and in a somehow perfect way. That's ridiculous. But I can see a few things here and there. No planning is planning. No planning is planning to fail. And I've seen so many times where that kind of thing has happened. Let me make one thing clear to you, because you might get the wrong impression by what I've said so far. I believe that most Christians want to do right. I really do. I think though sometimes because they don't provide personal leadership in their lives, and maybe leadership in the congregation isn't provided the way it should be, that there's just not the direction. And so what happens is churches begin to just drift. Just kind of like out on a river or out in a lake, and you don't have your anchor there and you're just drifting along. And it's like, well, where are we going? Well, I don't know, but now I'll tell you one thing. We're going to put out the fires when they come up. You know, here's a fire here. Let's go over and put that out. And you spray it all over with it. Let's put out a fire over there. And you have to deal with problems. And problems are there. Ananias and Sapphira and Demas and Diotrephes, they're there. But I'm going to tell you, it needs to be more than that. I wonder how many young people... I'm serious about this. I wonder how many young people, how many weak in the Lord, have actually gotten discouraged and just fallen away. Not because of something someone did in the world, necessarily, but because the church itself was not really going in a direction. It's kind of drifting around. How many people of the world really don't look at the Lord's people like they should? Because the Lord's people aren't doing, aren't being led, aren't planning, aren't going somewhere, the place the Lord has told us to go. You know, it's interesting. Dave mentioned Wednesday night about the plan we have coming up this next year to have the narrative cycle of the Bible study. And I want to just tell you right now that I've been through that several times. And most people really like it. But at the first, sometimes you have people that, I don't know. I know the Bible. I've been through that. But I will tell you this, you give it some time, and you really implement it in a wholehearted way, and everybody involved in it. And I have found very, very few people. In fact, I can't really recall anybody right now that after we got into it and did it, that said, I do not like this. But it's going to take planning. And sometimes people may be a little cynical about that. Well, I don't know if that's going to... But we need to recognize that it's going to take all of us following that plan. Another thing that needs to be said in regard to the leadership of Nehemiah is that the leadership he showed, and anybody's leadership that's good, stirs good people and stands against bad people. That may sound very simplistic, but it's so important. You see something that Nehemiah did here. Let's look in chapter 2 again. Look at verse 17, please. In fact, let me just read verses 17 and 18. Then I said to them, you see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lies waste and its gates are burned with fire. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach. And I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also of the king's words that he had spoken to me. So they said, let us rise up and build. Then they set their hands to do this good work. You know, it takes that sometime, doesn't it? It takes a person saying, let's do it. Let's go. Let's get busy. It doesn't always have to be the elders and deacons, necessarily. Or the preacher. Sometimes elders and deacons are a little bit afraid that somebody's going to raise the charge. Well, you're lording it over us. You're acting like king. They may be a little reluctant at times. I've been in several congregations, good men. They know the places they're going to get hit, though, in the congregation. And a preacher, you know, a preacher's always talking. Oh, the preacher's talking about doing, yeah, I know, he's having one of his spells again. He'll lie down after a while and calm down. Just kind of let him blow it off. He'll have to get that over with that eventually. You know, that's preacher talk. And sometimes in the church, there are people who have ideas. And they want to say, let us rise up. Let's do it. But they're afraid they'll come across in a pushy way and they don't want to look like they're usurping authority. Somebody needs to do that, though. Somebody in a business meeting or an informal arrangement needs to say, here are some ideas that we have and we need to do them. And yet, sometimes that's resented, especially if a person's relatively new. And I'm not talking about me. I know one place I lived at, there was a young man who came in and he had some ideas and he was saying, let's do this and let's go. And he got shot down pretty well. We need to talk and think about building, and we have to think about the building because we need the room. And this is not a slap at that at all. But what I'm saying is there have been many times where I've been in a business meeting where we've talked about the cleaning of the building, the roofing of the building, the this of the building, the that of the property. What we need is we need to think about the people of the community. The people of the church. The spiritual things that need to be dealt with. And I want to tell you that you can do some leadership, some leading in a special way that I can't, and in a very real sense that the elders and deacons can't. Before I became a preacher, the preacher, there was a sense in which I could relate to people on a level that I no longer could when I became the preacher. And there are things that you can do to lead, things that you can do to help, that you may not understand. And did you notice in verse 18 here, the people said, let us rise up and build. Let us do it. He had stirred the hearts of these people. I've been a part of visitation groups. I've been a part, and I remember one place I lived, brethren said, this I've been preaching about a year. Imagine that. We want you to teach us how to have home Bible studies. That was interesting. But I did my best. We had classes during the week, and I tried to teach them how to have home Bible studies, how to go about it. I've been a part of other kind of group activities. But like one man said to me one time several years ago, he said, well, we can do this if you want, but my experience is it all kind of fizzles out. You know? Take a big pail of cold water and whoosh. And I'll tell you, it will fizzle out. It will fizzle out. Unless there is the planning, unless there is the setting our minds and our hands to do what God has told us to do. We need to quit waiting for David's mighty men and for Samson. We need to quit waiting for David himself, King David. We need to see who is behind it all. And we need to see who our motivation is. And if you look back to chapter 2 and verse 19, Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, the enemies of God's people, laughed at them. What are you doing? Rebelling against the king? Look at verse 20. So I answered them and said to them, the God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore we his servants will arise and build, but you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. Our God is going to help us. And I'll tell you, a lot of what we accomplish is going to just come down to that. Do you believe God lives? Do you? Do you believe that he really has any concern for us? Do you believe that he's all-powerful, trustworthy, truthful? Then he'll carry out the work he's told us to do if we'll do what he's told us to do. And we need to be careful. And I've been caught up in this. And the things I'm talking to you about, I've been guilty of, you know. What can I do? Who am I? What difference can I make? But you know, that is exactly what Moses said to God when God first came to him when he was in the wilderness. And God said, come, I want you to go back and go to Pharaoh and help deliver my people from Egypt. And Moses said, who am I? And God essentially said, Moses, it doesn't make any difference who you are. It's who I am that makes the difference. And that's what you need to remember. And that's what we need to remember. It is good for us to have that self-esteem. It is good for us to have that confidence. But we can't achieve without Him. Let me just say very quickly on this that as you continue to study the book of Nehemiah, chapter 5 of verse 3, verse 5 of chapter 3, and then chapter 5, the first 10 verses, right in the midst of all of that growth, there were problems. I already mentioned Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem. They weren't Israelites. And they're there to try to mess up the work and throw a wrench in the cogs. And they come back in the story again and again. Nehemiah essentially says the same thing. We've got a great work. God's with us. We're busy. We can't bother with you. But I want to tell you what really hurts. What really hurts is when people among ourselves, our own brethren, create the problem. The nobles in chapter 3 and verse 5, some of the nobles of some of the people did not set their shoulder to the work, and you'll find that everywhere you go. There are some people that this lesson is just going to be another lesson, and that's, you know, nice and pretty, and let him talk. And then in chapter 5, there were some who were loaning money with interest, demanding interest from the brethren, and when they couldn't repay, then they had to give their lands, then they had to sell their children into captivity, and Nehemiah came among them and basically said, "Can't you see what's going on? Can't you see that for 90 years this place has been desolate as far as the walls? And that we are engaged in a great work and you're getting interest from your own brethren? Stop it!" Nobody likes to have to deal with problems. In fact, I suppose that's one of the least enjoyable things of leadership. But it is one of the necessary things of leadership. And I do not say that in any kind of ugly way. I'm saying it in a factual way. Nehemiah dealt with those problems. And when he finished dealing with the problem of his own brethren, they repented and did the right thing. Well, at last, we see that leadership brings about a successful end. You know how long it took to build the walls of Jerusalem? Look in chapter 6. I want you to read this. Just very short reading. Chapter 6, let's look at verse 15, please. Chapter 6, verse 15. So the wall was finished on the 25th day of the month of Elul. I don't know if I pronounced that right. In 52 days. And it happened when all our enemies heard of it, and all the nations around us saw these things, that they were very disheartened in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was done by our God. How long did it take to rebuild the walls? 52 days. Isn't that interesting to you? Almost 100 years those walls are in desperate condition, and yet they come back and they do it in 52 days. How in the world can that happen? Leadership. Like I said before, there are a lot of people. There are a lot of people here. There are a lot of people, good people, in churches all over, that are willing and ready. Many have already shown that here, that you're willing and ready. But sometimes what happens is people, as they begin to try to step out and do some things, they have a setback here and a setback there, and they may get back and they begin to hibernate. And we look at each other and say, "Well, those people don't care. They don't care whether we achieve anything. They're just disinterested." And you know, in some cases, that may be right. But in many cases, that's not right. You have people who have been bitten or hurt, and they are afraid. And they need somebody to come up and put an arm around them, like Barnabas did to Saul when he came in Acts chapter 9, and tell the brethren, "This man has seen the Lord, this man's a faithful Christian, and you can trust him." And they need somebody coming up and saying, "Let's go. There are things you can do. Even if you can't teach a home Bible study right now, you can do lots of things. You can visit. You can take people medicine. You can mow yards." I don't know if I told you yet about a fellow that mowed my yard. Of course, I didn't exactly need it. He was a little bit... He had a lot of nervous tension. Got home one day and my yard was mowed. I just about did a jig. You know, I was dreading having to cut it. Can you imagine an elderly person who's fretting, "How am I going to get this yard?" And you mow the yard. And you take the food. You send the card. Brother Allen used to do, you pick up the telephone and you call people. And not necessarily unfaithful people. You know one thing we need to remember? Faithful people need encouraging too. To keep them faithful. And we need to remember that good people need encouragement. They need direction. You know the difference between a good work and a great work? A good work is one that you're doing. I'm talking about the way we look. A great work is one I'm involved in, even if I'm not doing that much. Remember when I was a freshman, I believe, in high school, we went over to Tupelo, Mississippi, our rivals. Their homecoming. I didn't play a lick. I was scared to death he might put me on the field. But I was a part of it. I played up against those guys that played them, and they beat me all over the field to get ready to play them. We upset them that night. Great comeback, 15-14, and we went off that field, and we were so excited. I mean, I was just jumping up and down. Yeah, we beat them. I didn't play a down. But I was a part of it. See what I'm saying? One place I lived at that we did this narrative cycle Bible study, there was a man who's not that great of a teacher. He's not that great of a teacher, but you know what he did? He built the Ark of the Covenant. He did. Not the real one, but I mean, you know. He built an Ark of the Covenant. And he took it off, and he had a rod that was budding down there, and he had the pot of manna. And they take those in. And there were people who built all kinds of things. Illustrative materials. I mean, it's just like lighting a fire under people. That's success. And I'll tell you something else it takes to have really good leadership is you've got to have good followship. And I know that's not a word, but that sure is a good idea, isn't it? You can have the most qualified elders and deacons. I mean, they can be impeccable in the way they meet those qualifications. But you have people that won't pray for them and won't support them and won't hold their hands up and won't follow them, and you're going to have a failure. But you have people that stand out like they did with Nehemiah. He said, let us rise up and build. And he gave them those words of encouragement and told them how God had been with him. And they said, let us do it. Let us rise up and build. And I know that this story is corny to some people. I know people think this is relegated to a time of miracles and all of that. But let me ask you something. How many miracles really came about in that story? Yeah, God prayed and he prayed, and God gave him the strength. But you know, a lot of what happened in the book of Nehemiah is stuff that can happen today through God's providence. And I wonder sometimes what the Lord thinks about me. I tell you, I thought about that. And I don't mean for this to come across in a wrong way. I mean for it to come across in a good way. Who in the world, what in the world am I going to say in the day of judgment if I'm lost? There won't be much to say. I've had every kind of advantage in the world. And that's true for many of you in this audience today. And the Bible is full of examples that we've talked about. Auburn is not a dead church. Auburn's a good church. And I have been to churches that were almost dead. In fact, I'm thinking of one right now. And you know, people just, that church is dead. That church hadn't done anything for years. The leadership in that church woke up and said, in fact, direct quote, man said to me, we are tired of sitting on our hands. We want to work. And our church began to grow, and others began to realize that they could be leaders. And things changed. You know, going up to this new building up here is good, but if we don't work, and if we're just going to kind of keep house, like a lady told me one time, she said, you know, David, she said, I want you to know that I am really discouraged. Because the church that I attend, she said, really, we're just keeping house. That's all we're doing. That's a terrible thing to say. But it's true sometimes. But the great message, the great thing is, I've kept house in my life at times. Man, oh man. I've been in churches where we were just keeping house. And we need to remember that, again, it doesn't make any difference who we are. It's who God is that makes the difference. Or just a small place in Auburn, Alabama. Galilee was just a small place. Nazareth was just a small place. But I'll tell you, if God is with you, who can be against you? You're going to have trouble, but you're going to have success. A lesson like this is not intended to make you feel bad, not intended to make me feel bad. It's intended to encourage us. We've got all the tools here. I mean, let's face it. We've got people here that are very smart, very capable, relate well with people. We have people here that are already working on the university with people, studying with individuals, and others that are talking with people, I'm sure privately, opening their homes to have Bible studies. All that's wonderful. But the future is bright if we want it to be. And we just have to reach out further and trust in God more. If you need to make your life right in any way, do it now while we stand, while we sing.